Joining us is Rebecca Alvin, founder and programmer for the Cape Cod Festival of Arab and Middle Eastern Cinema. Welcome to the program, Rebecca.
Thank you very much.
So this is the third year you've been running the festival. What prompted you to bring Arab and Middle Eastern films to the Cape?
Well, it began in 2012, when I was thinking about what had happened with the Arab Spring. And I, as a film person, was immediately wondering, what are Arab filmmakers doing? They must be making, you know, all kinds of films about this. And then I realized that I didn't even really know that many Arab filmmakers or know that much about it, even though I'd spent my life studying film. So I started to look into that. And from there, in the second version of it, I added Middle Eastern cinema as well, because people kept asking me about Iranian films and Turkish films. And I think in our minds, those areas are very much connected, even though they're very distinct countries.
Right. So what's the criteria for the films to be admitted to the festival, and how do you decide which films to include?
Well, first of all, the obviously the topic, you know, it has to relate, but I try really hard to bring films that are made by filmmakers who are Arab themselves, or who are living in those countries, or who are Middle Eastern. And also try to get a range of subjects, because I think in American media, we tend to think of the Arab world and the Middle East as, first of all, the same thing, and that all of the countries are only concerned about hating America and the Israel-Palestine conflict. And in reality, there are many different cultures with many different issues and just as many diverse stories to tell. So I try to get some diversity of stories.
Let's talk about some of the films being screened. Flying Paper is a documentary that features children in Gaza who are creating handmade kites as part of an effort to reach a Guinness World Record for the most kites ever flown at one time. And joining us on the phone is the director and co-producer of Flying Paper, Nitan Sawani. Good morning to you.
Good morning. It's really lovely to be here.
Yeah, so this isn't just a film about the children themselves, but they participated in the filming and production. So tell us how you got involved working with the children.
I've been teaching filmmaking workshops in Palestinian refugee camps for many years. I initially worked in Jerusalem and the West Bank. And when I had the chance to go to Gaza about 4 years ago, I decided that we would build a similar program in the Jabalia refugee camp there. So we spent several weeks working with a women's community center and training their staff, and then training kids in the ages of 12 to 16 to work with us in producing short films, photography, narratives about their lives. And we felt that that was a way for us to have them develop the kind of tools and ways of expressing, you know, stories that mean something to them. The film, documentary film, was not my intention initially. It was really just meant to be a program to support youth in Gaza. And then when we heard that the United Nations was planning to facilitate a large festival of kite flying to break the world record, we thought it would be great to work with our kids to cover that festival and to cover the stories of kids who'd be part of the festival. But what it turns out that we began actually working with some very interesting characters, siblings who we followed throughout the film. And the festival almost became a backdrop to their stories.
Yeah. The Flying Paper centers around a boy named Musa, who's a gifted kite maker who seems much wiser than his ears. Tell us a little bit more about him.
Yeah, we stumbled upon Musa and his sister Vidad in a small village just to the north of Gaza, very close to the border with Israel. It's literally 750 meters from the Israeli checkpoint and watchtowers. And their village is very much cut off from most of Gaza. It's very hard for them to even get to school and clinics from the village. But what they do have in the village is extraordinary solidarity with families, lots of kids, farms. They live a very rural and extraordinary life in those places. And the one thing they love doing there is kite making and kite flying. For many generations, their grandfather, their parents, all of them have a love for kite flying and kite making. So naturally, as we began working with these kids, it became clear to us that they have all of this energy, all of this artistic talent, and all of this sort of affection to the art and science of making kites. And all of the kids were doing that. But Musa was really their leader in a sense. He was only 13 or 14 at the time and was very much the master kite maker, had really worked very closely with his grandfather, Abu Ziyad, to develop these skills. And his sister was learning with him, and they would constantly squabble about who can make the best kite. And so we had them, you know, really show us their kite-making skills and compete, and then lead up to the large festival. They were very much a part of filming that festival with us and being a part of that whole process.
Then Abir is a teenager and budding journalist. We see her on camera, but she also contributes a lot behind the scenes. So tell us more about her and her contribution to the film.
Absolutely. Abir was about a 16-year-old young woman who began working with me in the Jabalia refugee camp. She was one of my students who trained very well with us and was the most astute student. She really wanted to be a journalist at some point, and I think this film was an opportunity for her to bring her investigative talents. So she helped us. She really served as our co-producer in the film and helped us scout locations, scout characters, interview the characters with us, and was very much behind the camera plotting the production. But over time, we began to realize that she has this charisma that we wanted to bring in front of the camera, tell a part of the story of Gaza that you couldn't fully hear from the young siblings, their kite-making. So Abir becomes this interlocutor about the challenges of life in Gaza as a young teenager and what it means to persist there and have a kind of resilience there despite the odds. So she interjects herself in a very shy way throughout the film, talking about her life, but also talking with these kids, and is a fantastic presence throughout the film.
Yeah. The children in the film are amazing. Despite the fear and uncertainty of living in a conflict zone, they remain hopeful, engaged, and able to see the beauty in life. Would you say that they're representative of the majority of the Palestinian children that you've come to know?
You know, I would say yes. Many, many Palestinian children and youth are hopeful, but they're doing so despite very, very difficult odds. And I've seen a whole range of kids working there over the years, ones who are deeply traumatized by many incidents of war and conflict, and also challenges within their own communities, but also others who tend to put on a really good face and tend to have a sense of humor and playfulness that I think sometimes we don't even find with kids here in North America, because they're very much out in the streets, they're very much dealing with everyday life, they're very much in control of their sort of local lives in their neighborhoods. They have a sense of agency that I think is very extraordinary, despite being blockaded and being in a constant sense of violent conflict. So yes, they are to some extent indicative of many of the kids, but they're also very, very special kids. I mean, we kind of auditioned a number of kids, and we found that they had the most screen-savvy presence and the most sort of compelling stories to tell, and that's why they became part of the film.
I just wanted to add that part of the reason that I chose The Flying Paper to be in the festival is because of this hopefulness on the part of the children. I think when we see that there is hope, it gives us a different message that maybe there is some sort of answer, you know, or something to work with instead of just seeing all the darkness and negativity.
Mm, yeah. Flying Paper was filmed around 2010, 2011, somewhere in that area, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So do you know what Musa and Abir are doing now?
Yes, we've actually been following them very much so over the years. My co-producer and Pak, who is a human rights photographer, a very renowned photographer, has been going to the region regularly. I've been back several times, but she has been working closely with Abir, who is now in university studying journalism as a career, learning English. And Abir has gotten this real confidence as a young woman. And she's now directing her own plays and is starting to produce a short film. So we've taken a very shy young teenager and in some ways helped her think about her career very differently. She is one of 12 children in a family and the oldest of them. And so she bears a lot of responsibility as the youngest girl. Her father mother has passed away, but she has remained very resilient and very strong, and is deeply respectful and kind about how she participates in our projects. Now, Musa and Vidad, the siblings, on the other hand, have had a different trajectory. What we found is that they have turned inwards more so because of the way the village where they live and the kind of challenges they've struggled with in the last two wars since we were with them. And Vidad has become completely reserved and will no longer talk on camera. Musa is very shy, but still has the wisdom of a young man. But his entire family's home was destroyed in the last conflict in the summer of July of last year, and they had to be evacuated by the ICRC through Anne's intervention. So they've been through a lot of trauma and had been displaced, but we've recently gone back to speak with them again, and they're back on their feet, and the family's trying to recover and deal with their surroundings. So we're continuing to follow these young people in a sequel that we hope to finish sometime this year, where we talk about what's happened to these kids 5 years later and how they represent the condition for many Gazan families and young people there.
Yeah. Listen, you're going to be on the Cape talking about your film and some of the other Palestinian films in the festival. Any you'd like to mention quickly now that you'll be talking about?
Yes, we're showing a film called Mars at Sunrise, which I believe you're familiar with, Nitin.
Yes. Nitin
was the co-founder of the Boston Palestine Film Festival, and there were two Palestinian films that I saw at this past year's festival. One was Mars at Sunrise, and the other one was My Love Awaits Me by the Sea.
The film My Love Awaits Me by the Sea is really quite poetic, and the director, there's someone I've come to know. I have to say, it's a first personal essay that chronicles her own visit to Palestine, and it's beautifully, beautifully done.
We'll have a link to the schedule of films and screening times for the Cape Cod Festival of Arab and Middle Eastern Cinema at our website, capeandislands.org. Nitin Sahwani, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
Rebecca, let's talk about some of the other films that you'll be screening. In 2012, the Iranian film A Separation won the Oscar for the Best Foreign Language Film. And for many Iranians, this was more than a cinematic award. And you're not going to be showing A Separation. You're going to be showing another film called From Iran, A Separation. So tell us about that.
Yes, I want to be clear about that. When I started doing this festival, many people asked me about the film A Separation, and there was great enthusiasm for that. So, of course, I have seen A Separation. In Iranian culture, cinema is very important, actually, and many of the filmmakers there, under great duress, have managed to make incredibly provocative, critical, fascinating films there. And so it's a vibrant film culture despite a lot of the restrictions on it. This documentary, From Iran, A Separation, shows the reaction both in Iran and in the Iranian diaspora around the world as they watch the Academy Awards. And it, for them, felt like such a victory to get, you know, first of all, it's the Academy Awards. It's a huge award. And it's an American award at a time where we have, of course, sanctions with Iran. So I think the reason I chose that film was because it shows something that I believe very much, which is the power of cinema for a culture that believes in it, and how that can bring people together, and people can it can foster understanding among very different cultures,
and even among the same. You see in this documentary the discussions and the debates between Iranians themselves about the controversy this film creates.
Yes, absolutely. Both with that film and another Iranian film I'm showing called "Bending the Rules," which is more about the intergenerational differences. In that film, there is a theater troupe that they have an opportunity to perform abroad, but because the father of one of the female actors won't let her go because of, you know, what we might think of as outdated ideas about women, there becomes this conflict. And so you see that a lot in the Iranian films that I've seen. this idea of two competing ideas in their culture, which I think we have a lot in common with them in that regard.
Yeah, it was a fascinating film to watch. And even just the things we don't think about. This film, by the way, Separation, won a lot more than our Oscar.
Yes.
It won many, many
yes.
awards around the world. But it was interesting, the controversy even over, you know, who's shaking hands and
right.
you know, the do's and the don'ts of what you're supposed to do when you're, you know, accepting an international award and, you know, honoring your own customs, and then you're thinking about
it. Exactly.
It was really fascinating, wasn't it, to watch
yes,
that?
Yes, absolutely.
Then another film, Bag of Flour, which is based on a true story of an 8-year-old girl who lives in a Catholic foster home in Belgium. Her father appears out of nowhere to take her for a weekend in Paris. She ends up in Morocco, where her education involves knitting.
Yes.
Tell us about that film.
Well, this is a really great film, and it's an example of how in the Arab world there's a lot of co-productions going on. It's by a woman filmmaker, Khadija Leclerc, and it's based on her own experience, actually. She is Belgian and Moroccan, and the film is a co-production between Belgium, Morocco, and France. And in that story, yes, her Moroccan father comes and takes her, brings her to this Moroccan village, and leaves her there where she doesn't know anyone. She doesn't even know that she's supposed to be Muslim. Mm. She's been raised in a Catholic orphanage, so she's making the sign of the cross and praying. And how she sort of fits in there and always has in her mind that she's going back to Belgium. But then there is this torn feeling of also maybe in some way wanting to stay despite the difficulties in Morocco.
We are talking with Rebecca Alvin, founder and programmer for the Cape Cod Festival of Arab and Middle Eastern Cinema. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Rebecca Alvin, founder and programmer for the Cape Cod Festival of Arab and Middle Eastern Cinema. We have another filmmaker joining us on the line, Bahman Tavousi. His documentary is A Dress Rehearsal for an Execution. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. Glad to be with you.
And your film is inspired by the 1979 Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph of an execution in post-revolution Iran. And some listeners might not recall that image. So can you describe it for us?
Absolutely. The photo is actually taken on an August day right after the 1979 Iranian Revolution, in which the country experienced the basically revolutionary trials. So lots of political opposition members, they were put in these revolutionary trials, and the sentences were very much heavy, like there were death sentences and long imprisonments. This photo actually belongs to a scene of execution of 11 of these political prisoners in the western part of the country. And so it basically very quickly turned to be a very iconic image. You know, it won a Pulitzer Prize a year after, and it was published all over the world. All through this time, the photographer was hiding his identity because he was kind of fearing his life and his family's life. They were living in Iran. Until basically quite recently, I believe in 2006, that a journalist from Wall Street Journal, this man is kind of, intrigued and interested to go and find the photographer. So he travels to Iran and he basically finds Jahangir Azmi, the photographer of the photo, and then he encourages him to seize this long period of anonymity and go to States and receive his Pulitzer Prize. Mm. So thanks to Joshua Proger, the name of that journalist, today we know Jahangir Azmi and we know that the photo was taken by him.
Yeah. Why did you decide you've restaged the event and you create the documentary about the process. So where did you get that idea? Why did you want to do it that way?
Well, the idea of reenactment, and basically, as it is typically called, historical reenactment and restaging, that does not directly come from me, naturally. Earlier, early 19th century, for instance, in France, they had this very popular tradition in kind of entertainment industry of the time called the tableau vivant, in which they re-staged the famous kind of historical painting. So the idea of staging it a certain scene, basically when it comes to the photo, I was very much engaged with it from the first time that I saw it. I was, I think, 17, 18 years old. And at that time, even the photographer of the photo was not known to the world. So by the time that basically I learned to I learned basically the name of the photographer, and I learned more about the history kind of behind the photo and everything. I decided to start, taking kind of a creative approach to the photo. Mm. I didn't want to come up with a direct or necessarily, a realistic kind of report or a documentary or documentation of those events that led to the photo, etc. So I wanted to rather have my own kind of creative touch. Mm-hmm. Through this process of kind of remaking of the photo.
So tell us about casting the roles of the executioners and the prisoners.
You know, in the first place, because I started, naturally, I wasn't able to think of this project when I was in Iran, because it's quite a controversial image. But it was just when I arrived in Canada in 2006 that they started developing the idea. Then I thought, since the project is going to take place in Canada, which is pretty much a multicultural society, then I thought that it would be a better idea, instead of kind of limiting the photo to its local context, that is Iran and that 1979, post-revolution, et cetera, to in a way kind of universalize the image and the experience behind it, because it belongs strongly to kind of context of 20th century. It's very much comparable to many other iconic images that we know from the 20th century. Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of famous Pulitzer winning photos that, you know, from Vietnam, from China, etc. Mm-hmm. And this was the context in which I wanted to kind of posit and locate the photo.
Yeah.
So I started universalizing the work and work with actors from all over the world who have gone potentially through the same or similar experiences, from South Africa, from Zimbabwe, from France, post-Second World War France, and Poland, and countries like that.
Yeah, and the film starts in that. A lot of people will be very familiar with the images, which is exactly how mm-hmm. the film starts, and we see a lot of those iconic images that we've seen.
Exactly.
And now we have a clip from one of the cast members. This is Kenneth, who portrays one of the executioners.
Hi, my name is Kenneth Mpamba. I'm from South Africa. My roots go all the way back to Zimbabwe. I've been here in Montreal for almost 3 months now. And also, like, for an example, what has been happening in the documentary, it's similar to what happened to my grandfather back in Libya in 1963. His name was Kenneth Shange. I was also named after him. Apparently, unfortunately, actually, he died during trying to free the South African people from apartheid in 1963. It's also kind of touchy to be working in this project, and it kind of reminds and bring a lot of pain on the time that we missed out a lot, you know, like we never got to know him, and it's kind of the things that even haunt my family up until now, you know. So I'd really like to say this is real, and a lot of people actually suffer up until today because of things like this that has happened in the past. But I'm very honored to be a part of this.
That was a clip from a dress rehearsal for an execution. Bahman, what do you hope viewers will take away from the film?
Well, naturally, a great, I think, portion of it would be the story of the photo itself, because even though the photo might have been kind of seen by a lot of people, and it might have been known, but the story behind it is not is not as kind of known. So part of it is that, and part of it is, again, the concept of universalization and the universal experience. It was very much important for me to kind of, you know, go through that process and create that universal image instead of, you know, just limiting the experience to certain kind of geographies and certain kind of context.
Yeah. Bafan Davousi, his film A Dress Rehearsal for an Execution will be screened at the Cape Cod Festival of Arab and Middle Eastern Cinema. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we're also talking with Rebecca Alvin, founder and programmer for the festival. Another film that looks really interesting to me is Fifi Howls for Happiness. Tell us about that film.
Yes, this is a film by Iranian filmmaker Mitra Farahani. And it is a documentary about the modern Iranian artist, sculptor, Bahman Mohassis, who lived for much of his later life in exile because he, like many artists in Iran, ran afoul of the powers that be. The filmmaker Mitra Farahani herself also has had trouble with the Iranian authorities. So it's interesting on a lot of different levels. Also, we are showing this at the in Provincetown at the Water's Edge Cinema. This is a co-presentation with the Provincetown Film Society. Bahman Mohassis was also a gay artist, which, as you can imagine, in Iran made things even more difficult. But he is just a really charming, fascinating guy.
Eccentrically, yeah, it seems like a very eccentric man. And he, for people not familiar with his work, he was a so-called Persian Picasso.
Yes.
So there's some sort of similarities there. It looks like it'd be, I only saw the trailer, but it looked like an interesting, like he was a very interesting man. I guess he left his country over 30 years ago and moved to Italy. And
it was not known where he was, and Mitra Farahani went on a quest to find him, and that's part of the documentary. I want to also add that when we're showing the film, we're not just showing the film, we're bringing with us a Iranian art expert. Her name is Shiva Balahi, and she's also a visiting fellow at Brown University. She's coming, and she will be. She's very familiar with his work, and we'll be discussing that at the screening.
Right. So the film festival runs April 30th through May 3rd. We'll have a link to the schedule of films and screening times for the Cape Cod Festival of Arab and Middle Eastern Cinema at our website, capeandislands.org. Rebecca Alvin, founder and programmer for the Cape Cod Festival of Arab and Middle Eastern Cinema. Thank you for bringing the films, and we'll have be some panel discussions. There'll be the filmmakers either in person or on Skype.
Yeah, a lot of Skype Q&As.
Looking forward to it. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.